Welcome to Business and Human Rights with Rochelle. I've worked in the intersection of business and human rights for nearly three decades, and I'm using this podcast to bring you relevant weekly news and occasional in-depth discussion of critical issues. My focus has been the global supply chain across sectors like agriculture, manufacturing, and extractives. I've done fieldwork in over 100 countries and hope to bring my insight and experience as a practitioner in business and human rights to this podcast. Thanks for joining me. It's March 6th, 2023, and here's a highlight of recent news. Last weekend, the New York Times released an investigative report on child labor in the United States. I'm going to do a deep dive on this topic after the news, but let's get grounded in the headlines first. Reporters spoke to 100 migrant children in 20 states, as young as 12 years old, working in roofing in Florida and Tennessee, in slaughterhouses in Delaware, Mississippi, and North Carolina, sawing wood planks in overnight shifts in South Dakota, washing sheets in Hawaii, running milking machines in Vermont. They named a wide range of companies and operations where child labor was found, including garment production for J. Crew, baking rolls for Target and Walmart, and making auto parts for Ford and General Motors. The article focuses on the breakdown of child protection systems that should have helped ensure children were in school when they were admitted to the country as refugees from Central America. Pressure to release children from border detention facilities quickly and get them into sponsorship situations prevented a robust level of due diligence of sponsors and follow-up to check on child welfare. The article highlights the dangerous working conditions these children have faced, including exposure to chemicals and work at night. This news followed on an October 2022 Department of Labor investigation of a cleaning company engaged to clean hundreds of slaughterhouses across the U.S. The cleaning contractor was fined for hiring over 100 children to work in night shift cleaning operations using harsh chemicals to clean kill floors. The DOL investigation has been called the largest ever for the number of children found working. A recent follow-up on that investigation, published this last weekend, reported on some of the children who lost their jobs after the Department of Labor intervention. Some have had parents or guardians arrested and facing jail time for contravention of state labor laws. Labor officials said that caring for the minors is not part of their departmental mission, but that they tried to refer the children to schools and federal agencies that could provide support. But those without papers or parents without papers are afraid to reach out if it means getting deported. There are reportedly legal protections for these workers, but aid organizations are not able to contact workers and counsel them as to safe avenues for relief without knowing who the children are. The Department of Labor says they cannot release the information due to privacy concerns. In the meantime, as a result of the New York Times investigation, the Biden administration announced last week it would crack down on labor exploitation of migrant children. The Department of Labor stated it would target larger companies that have children in their supply chain, often employed through agencies and third-party service providers, allowing the companies plausible deniability of the presence of children. They also stated they intend to use the hot goods provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which prevents interstate transfer of goods made with child labor. The government also intends to establish a joint task force between the Department of Labor and the Department of Health and Human Services, which is responsible for the well-being of child migrants. HHS officials also stated they will correct gaps in their hotline for children, which the Times investigation found children had used to report abuse but gotten no response or assistance. Hotline operators will now be directed to return calls to children and inform them which local law enforcement agency will follow up with them. In related news, last month, Hyundai announced it would divest its 72% ownership share in an Alabama-based auto parts plant that last summer was discovered by journalists to employ children as young as 12. Since that report from July 2022, as many as 10 other Hyundai suppliers were under investigation by state and federal agencies related to child labor. As with the slaughterhouses and food production sites in other news, the children in the Hyundai supply chain were hired via staffing agencies and presented false documentation. Meanwhile, in Iowa, Republican state legislators are trying to expand the work that children can legally undertake and offering to exempt employers from liability if the children become sick, injured, or killed on the job. Other states, including Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and New Jersey, have considered legislation to expand the number of allowable work hours for 14 and 15-year-olds. New Jersey signed theirs into law last summer, but legislation in other states is at early stages. There is plenty going on this issue in the U.S., and we will dig into it shortly. For now, other headlines around the world. AG Recruitment, a British recruitment agency that brought over 1,400 Indonesians to work on farms in the UK, has lost its license. The agency previously recruited Ukrainians, but pivoted to Indonesia after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Indonesians reported having as much as £5,000 of debt to recruiters after arriving to the country for work, despite only having work for one season. Hundreds had sought diplomatic help after arriving late in the season and finding there was not enough work to pay off their debt. At least 100 workers went underground to try to find work to allow debt repayment, leading to the agency's canceled license since workers were not returned home on time. As the Formula One races are set to launch in the Mideast in March, the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy asked the F1 and their governing body, the FIA, not to sportswash the images of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, which are hosting races. Sportswashing refers to governments using high-profile sporting events to project a favorable image of their country, despite negative practices taking place under oppressive governmental regimes. Articles noted that the Saudi government executed 80 people in one day last year, and Bahrain has the highest rate of imprisonment of any country in the Mideast, with 1,300 political prisoners. British politicians condemned the F1's refusal to engage with key stakeholders, including human rights groups, before awarding Bahrain the longest contract in F1 history, breaching the F1's own policy. The F1 CEO responded by stating they have a commitment to human rights and are proud of their partnership in Bahrain. Norwegian soccer officials have indicated they plan on using the March 16th FIFA Congress in Rwanda to call on FIFA to fulfill its commitment to provide remedy when it has caused or contributed to adverse human rights impacts. Specifically, they will ask FIFA to compensate migrant workers and families of those who died or were injured on World Cup projects in Qatar. Migrant workers in Qatar working to construct stadiums, hotels, and metro lines to support the event suffered wage theft, illegal recruitment fees, injuries, and even death. The Norwegian Soccer Federation said that a Qatar government fund used to reimburse unpaid wages was not accessible to workers who had left the country or available to families of workers who died because their deaths were not investigated. After passing the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act, or UFLPA, last year, U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials say they've blocked more than 2,300 shipments from China's Xinjiang region, with over 280 of these being blocked in January alone due to forced labor concerns. A recent Wall Street Journal article notes the law instructs customs to bar goods with any ties to Xinjiang at any stage in production. Companies that operate with many tiers in their supply chain have found it challenging to trace the components and raw materials in their products back to the sources of origin. The law itself specifies that particular attention should be paid to imports of products containing cotton, tomatoes, and polysilicon, a component in solar panels. Therese Randazzo, director of the Forced Labor Division at Customs, spoke at an OECD forum recently and said, "There are serious compliance challenges for businesses with supply chains that trace to China, and that it's almost impossible to do adequate due diligence in China in general." That's it for the news. Now let's take a deep dive into child labor in the United States. To get started, I want to introduce my credentials to talk to you about this topic and then go into just the international standards for child labor, the U.S. law, how you might go about finding and detecting child labor, and possible solutions, specifically in the U.S. and in other areas of the world, and especially supply chains, which is my focus. So in the mid-90s in the United States, Kathy Lee Gifford, the talk show host, was accused of benefiting from child labor in the production of her clothing line in Honduras. It was a huge child labor scandal. She ended up becoming foundational in setting up monitoring programs to ensure things like child labor would not take place, especially in the export world, export processing zones. And around that time, I began working as what was then called a labor investigator in the private sector for companies, including the ones that were monitoring Kathy Lee's clothing line. And today it's really called social auditing. It's evolved a lot since then. But when I began doing this work, we were trained by former Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor federal investigators in how to find and detect child labor. And about 20 years after my initial training, I actually was invited to Washington, D.C. to train U.S. Department of Labor officials, not necessarily those who work in the field doing investigations, but those who work on issues of international child labor and who evaluate company programs and reports on the topics. So that really came full circle for me. So I've worked on behalf of the private sector, and I've also worked in multilateral institutions such as for UNICEF, which is the United Nations Children Fund. I've had the opportunity to draft background papers for UNICEF that were used to make recommendations to the G7 countries related to the Sustainable Development Goals, and also evaluate child protection measures for Venezuelan refugee children in different countries in Latin America. I've done coursework with Harvard on child protection and with the United Nations International Labor Organization, or ILO, on child labor regulations, and I'll go through some of their standards and what the ILO does shortly. From the time I began my field work, I have been in thousands of businesses around the world looking at the risks of child labor. In particular, I've done investigations in Central America after different NGO groups identified risks of child labor. I've gone to try to validate those concerns. I've done work in the Democratic Republic of Congo related to child labor in artisanal mining for cobalt. And I've done investigations on the ground in Indonesia related to the production of tin, which also is artisanal and therefore is the type of thing that children frequently become involved in. That's just a few examples from many years of work engaged on this issue. Finally, I'll just add that a number of years ago, I was appointed by the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture to something called the U.S. Consultative Group that was set up in order to create a set of recommendations to the government to make for the private sector as to how best to eliminate the risk of importing agricultural products that might have been made with child or forced labor. So what is child labor? To answer that, I'm going to refer to the ILO, which is the International Labor Organization. It's the only part of the United Nations that has a tripartite function. That means it includes not only government entities, but also employers' organizations and worker representatives. So the voices from all of those different stakeholders are present in the outputs of the ILO. And what they're most known for are the number of conventions and recommendations that they have drafted for well over 100 years that cover all topics related to labor, including child labor conventions. And there are a number of them. And what they do is try to create an international consensus through these negotiations and the drafting of the conventions, and then ask the member states to become signatories to the conventions and then adopt whatever way that country has provided for to adopt the standards espoused in the conventions into their national legislative structures. Now, there are 11 of these conventions that are considered to be fundamental. So regardless of whether or not an individual country decided to ratify the convention, there is an expectation in the international community that they should be adhering to the terms of the convention. And those topics covered by those 11 instruments include freedom of association, forced labor, as well as child labor and some other topics. But this is where we find the international consensus around the concept of child labor. So what is child labor? The term itself is used to refer to work done by children, anyone under the age of 18, but it is work that in particular creates a harm or a type of abuse or exploitation of the child and may also deprive them of education. So it's not the same as legal work for minors, like if you find a 16 or 17-year-old working in a fast food place. That can be legal work, what we might call juvenile work. So there's different terms used, but when we say the word or the phrase child labor, we're actually talking about something that first off is harmful to children and secondly is illegal. So child labor is basically a global issue. It's not unique to the United States by any means. And the ILO publishes reports about every 2 years on the state of child labor. And the most recent one they published together with UNICEF to give us some global estimates. They indicated that there are about 160 million children around the world, and this data was from 2020, that were involved in child labor. And so again, that does not include kind of legitimate economic activity for youth, but in particular, the type of work that is unsafe for children. These numbers are huge. I have a report in front of me from 2006 that says there were 118 million children involved in child labor at the time. So there has been a huge decline, and I think that for a number of years, the global community was fairly excited about the progress being made around the world through the effort of many institutions, governments, and even the private sector. What we've really seen, and according to this latest ILO report, is that global progress against child labor has really stagnated in the last 6 or 7 years. And so we didn't see as much change or improvement in removing children from hazardous work. And that has not been helped by the pandemic. And when we really dig into the reason that we've seen this spike in child labor in the U.S., the COVID-19 pandemic is one of the direct causes for this. And we're not unique in that sense that this crisis has likely pushed millions of children into the workforce for many different reasons. So what is the international standard for child labor? The ILO has a convention called the Minimum Age Convention, and they call for the minimum working age to be linked to the end of compulsory schooling. So that you shouldn't really be able to enter the workforce until you've completed all the years of school that are required to be completed in that country. But they do specify that light work may be permitted as long as it doesn't interfere with schooling. And there's various definitions for light work that include things that aren't harmful to health or development of children. But the age that they recommend in any case is not less than 15 years of age. But they do make allowances that if it is a developing country, then it could be 14 as the youngest age for work. The majority of countries have set a general minimum age for work that aligns with the ILO standard. So most countries set it at 14, 15, or 16 years of age, and then they'll go on and they'll define what is hazardous work, and they'll usually outline the types of activities that are too dangerous for young children. And that is also the case in the United States. So we have at the federal level a basic minimum age for employment that 16 and 17-year-olds can basically work a normal sort of job, except those that have been declared hazardous. So there's just particular types of things that they should not be exposed to, dangerous machinery, dangerous chemicals, and things like that. And then there is an allowance for children aged 14 and 15 to do what we would call light work. So things that are not hazardous, not involved with manufacturing, and it's a very limited amount of time. Something that we have in particular in the U.S. that we don't always find in other countries is that You can employ children as young as 12 in agricultural endeavors. Agriculture tends to be the most predominant area in the world for child labor. 70% of children involved in child labor are involved at the agricultural level. And that's not always in family work, though in almost every country in the world, any type of family work, it's going to be legal to have that child working because it's a family business, although they should still be following laws requiring children to attend school. But family businesses are different, and agriculture in some countries is different. But because there are often pesticides used and machinery involved, a lot of countries actually specify that agricultural work is dangerous for children. So it just really depends country by country on the way these issues are handled. But why is child labor a problem globally? Obviously, that's a huge question to try to answer in a short podcast, but there are some recognized factors that drive child labor around the world, and I think you could probably guess that poverty is one of the main ones. Obviously, when families need income and need children to go to work and support the home and support the income of the household, that can often result in children being involved in work that is dangerous or interfering with their education and qualify them for work that's considered to be child labor. But poverty isn't the only reason for children to be working. Sometimes it's a social norm. It's not seen by that particular community as problematic. They may value children working and getting experience working over education and children being in school. There may also be barriers for those children to attend school. In a lot of countries, there are school fees that require local communities to help pay the salaries of teachers or pay for uniforms that are mandated or pay for the books and school supplies. And that can create barriers for children when there is not income available for that. And then, of course, there's just the general concept of supply and demand. If there is a shortage of workers, then there may be an incentive to try to get children involved in the workforce in order to overcome labor shortages. A number of years ago, I did a study in India in the sugar sector, where we were examining three major sugar regions in the country that were all very different. They were different economically, culturally, just about in every way. And we started in the west of the country and found that there were migrant workers who had come from the east, where they had been hit for a number of years with a drought, and they were no longer able to carry out subsistence farming. And so in order to survive, they would take the entire family and go travel for about 6 months out of the year to do harvesting for different crops, including sugar. And so we would find in the fields an entire family, teenagers down to little tiny kids, just being together. And obviously the older they were, the more that they could actually help and engage in the activities. But the parents were very focused on survival. That was critical. That was what they were there to do. And the thought of taking any of the kids and putting them to school just hadn't even crossed their mind. That was not their focus. And there were some barriers for them if they had wanted to do it, including languages being different, needing registration certificates from their home state in order to enroll and things like that. But frankly, they weren't even at that point yet. And then we went to the south of the country and we found something completely different. We found older women working in the fields and no children. And I found this to be curious. And I remember asking a group of women, why are you here? And I just remember the pride that they had in their voices as they explained to me that they were working so that their children could be in school. And one woman in particular put up her hand and said, "My daughter is an engineer." Now, this community and the women in this community really valued education. Well, their economic challenges were certainly different from the migrants. They were living at home. They didn't have to go out and migrate to find work. They were able to stay in their community. So their economic situation was different. And then their way of valuing education was also different. And it made all the difference for where those children were able to be located, in school or in the fields. I like sharing that example just because it shows the dynamic that can happen within one country and one sector, where there's just different factors in different communities that create different outcomes. But something that's universal is the impact to the child when they're involved in child labor. And one of the outcomes that we talk about is the poverty cycle. And the cycle is that, well, you have a poor family, so the children are working, like I saw in Western India. But then because they're working, they're not getting an education. And without that education, their income as they become an adult remains low. And so they begin the next generation in the same situation, and it remains a cycle of poverty. Now, I've definitely been in countries like Bangladesh and the Philippines where a factory owner would tell me, well, I'm employing children to help out the family. I know the family and the parents work here, so I've given the child a simple task of assembling boxes in the shipping area. It's not so much for me. It's a help to the family, and this is something that's done in the community. But nevertheless, I think the challenge is to change some of those viewpoints, because the reality is that children give up a lot when they're not in school. And children that are doing work that adults do, well, we lose sight of the fact that children are at greater risk than adults. And so the hazards and risks that might exist in that work environment affect children differently, because they're more susceptible to danger. For example, a child has 2.5 times more skin per body weight than an adult, and it's thinner skin, so it can result in greater absorption of toxins. A child breathes more deeply and frequently than an adult, so if they're exposed to hazardous substances, the impact to them is going to be different. Their brain matures differently, and it can be hindered by exposure to toxic substances. If they're exposed to metals, they're going to be retained in the brain more readily as a child, with greater absorption. And the list kind of goes on and on. Sleep, temperature, physical strain, cognitive and behavioral development. All of these things impact children differently than adults. And so we have to keep that in mind. In fact, their rates of injury are also different. In the United States, for example, the U.S. Department of Labor reports that the rate of injury is twice as high for children and adolescents in the workplace as it is for adults. So getting back to the topic of child labor in the United States in particular, why is this happening right now? Why are we seeing this spike in at least our identification of children working? And I think that there's a number of reasons that are classic drivers of child labor. One is migration is a classic driver for children to enter the workforce. Another is economic recession. And another we mentioned before, supply and demand. So it's just the worker shortage that we're seeing across the country. And all of those things are reasons for children to get pulled out of school and into the workplace. The news articles that I talked about at the beginning of the podcast actually do a great job of explaining why some of this is happening right now, as they go into some of the gaps of children crossing the border and coming into the country without sufficient welfare checks on their sponsorship situations and ensuring that they are in school, those situations not being followed up on. But there's another article that came out last week that talks about a government investigation now by, I want to say, the Department of Homeland Security, that's going to look at whether or not there is human trafficking and smuggling involved in bringing these children into the workforce in order to pay off recruitment debts or pay smugglers for the fees of getting them into the country. And that's not related to any particular company, but now that kind of the situation has been brought forward, they're going to look into that. So there's also risks related to labor trafficking, essentially, that these children have been brought over and trafficked into a situation where they're having to work to pay other people, possibly criminal gangs. So it does become quite a complex issue. The articles also call out a situation in which children are using fake documentation to obtain work. So they're showing kind of proof of eligibility that they're old enough to be hired, but the documentation is actually fake. And so part of the smuggling investigation is in order to determine whether or not even the provision of the documentation is being coordinated at this criminal level. Now, I mentioned earlier that children often work alongside family members, and that's been highlighted in some of these news articles that children are working with relatives or their relatives have gotten them the employment. And it was really interesting to read, I believe this was the New York Times investigative piece, where they do an interview with a hiring manager in the South who is dealing with a company, I think it's a poultry processing plant, that faces a lot of turnover, difficulty retaining workers, and is just struggling to hire. And the hiring manager talks about the challenge of having people come in to be interviewed and their feet don't even touch the floor. So she has reason to think that these are children that are too young to work there. But they've been brought in by adults to go through this interview, and they're providing documentation that's showing that they're old enough. And so she's kind of describing in this article some things that they do, like try to separate the children into a private room for interview where the adult that brought them in is not included, so that they can do their due diligence in the interview to really try to ascertain the true age of this individual. Now, this type of effort, this validation or this due diligence around confirming that the documentation that's been provided is legitimate, is a very important part of that hiring process, and really being able to have a conversation with the applicant, or you know, that you might think is a child, is really important in order to verify if this person really is able to work. Because again, it goes back to the safety of that individual, and just the exposure that they could face in a workplace is considerably different than the exposure would be for an adult. The challenge for a lot of the companies mentioned in the news articles is that the children were found working in agencies or companies that are providing a service to their plant or their organization. It's not someone that they directly hired, but they are benefiting from, or you know, harboring the place where this child labor is occurring. And so for them, it does require them to do due diligence of those companies and see that those companies are actually scrutinizing eligibility documents to ensure that children aren't accidentally being hired. In one of the articles, the other employees joke about the fact that some workers were very, very young, and their documentation said that they were 37 years old, and that it was a joke among them in the workplace. And so that just kind of tells you that no real credible due diligence of those documents took place at the time of hire. Another thing that came out in the articles was that the Department of Labor, as part of a new effort under the current administration to address some of these critical issues, wants to look at hot goods provisions. So hot goods they're provided for in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the labor law of the United States. And it basically is a provision to make it illegal to ship goods in interstate commerce if they were produced in violation of minimum wage or overtime requirements, or produced in or about an establishment where a child labor violation occurred in the past 30 days. So what the Department of Labor could essentially do is ask the company, basically tell them that they're prohibited to ship while there is an investigation going on. And if needed, they can actually ask a federal district court to issue an order against the shipment of those goods. And that would take place until the investigation is concluded, determining whether or not the goods could be used for interstate commerce. For some industries, it would be fairly devastating not to be able to ship goods while that type of investigation was underway, and could have a big impact on their business, which is, you know, basically the reason for having this sort of a thing. But there's also another component to hot goods provisions under the law, and that's called a good faith exception. And it basically says that the hot goods provision doesn't apply if the purchaser operated in good faith because they acquired the goods in good faith based on reliance of written assurance from the producer that the goods were produced in compliance with the FLSA. So there are ways for the producer and the purchaser basically to try to operate in good faith that would help protect them from this type of sanction. But to be able to use that, a company really would need to have in place a robust sort of due diligence, a little bit like what I talked about in the hiring process, different policies and procedures and management systems to show that they'd made all of these attempts to hire people that are legally eligible for work. Another question that I wanted to address here is, what do you do when you find child labor? And there is not necessarily an easy or clear answer to this, but there are some very good guidelines that are out there, and I want to share those with you. But first, I want to tell you a story about an experience that I had in Congo. When I was there a few years ago, I was a part of a team that was doing very holistic assessment of some artisanal cobalt mining. My role was to carry out the rapid labor, child labor assessment. So we're trying to gather data on the number of children that were involved in child labor at particular sites. And these sites were preparing to exclude children from the work area. So artisanal mining is largely informal. And the companies that were involved in purchasing didn't own the land. The land is owned by the government and given by concession to different operators. They didn't even have the concession, but they were trying to support the activity of mining cooperatives. And what they wanted to do was fence off the area, try to bring some formality to a largely informal activity. But when I got there, they'd already fenced it off. And this really complicated my job, because what I needed to do was to try to ascertain the scope of child labor. I wanted to do so at the sites that we were looking at, but I needed instead to pull back and try to do it at a macro community level, and talk to different people in the community and assess it in that way. It wasn't what I wanted, because I actually wanted to be able to know what was happening to the particular children that were going to be locked out of accessing work at that site. Because the site closed to children before I got there, the children could have gone anywhere, but they probably didn't end up magically in school. And for me, that was part of the point. For a company to look at that type of project, they need to be thinking about their responsibility as a beneficiary of the child labor to be able to correct impacts to that community by connecting children back into schooling and giving the family, the household, the support that they need as that income is being dropped away from them. So what I would have liked in that scenario is to be able to identify the households that had children working at the site, and then be able to track what was going to happen with them next. Now, this story, this experience comes to my mind because when I saw in the news, the Department of Labor had identified over 100 children working in slaughterhouses, my first thought was actually, where are they now? And then to read subsequent news reports where investigative journalists had gone in and identified that, well, the children are now working at different places in nearby communities. Which is very disappointing, but it's also what happens when there's not kind of a holistic response in order to remediate the child labor, which is a term that we use in the industry. So I want to touch on what should that look like? What is child labor remediation and what's considered best practice? There are different organizations that have been working on these issues for decades. One of them is the Ethical Trading Initiative out of the UK, and they developed years ago a base code that basically sets a standard for employment practices at any operation that says, you know, no forced labor, no child labor, decent work hours, pay living wages, have a safe workplace, things like that. That's a standard code of conduct. And they've elaborated really particular guidance around child labor remediation, and they were one of the first to do so. Another one is SA 8000, Social Accountability International's certification program. They also have a great guidance for remediating child labor. I'm going to focus on the ETI base code for this discussion because it's the first one that I really engaged with about 15, 16 years ago. They have what they call a do no harm principle when it comes to dealing with underage workers. So they give you some guiding points to think of. You know, first of all, the protection of the child and their interests comes first. So you're just orienting yourself around what's going to be in the best interest of this child. You don't just cut them out, fence them off from the site or, you know, close them out of the factory without any regard to what happens to them next. Because often what happens next is they get pushed into an even more vulnerable situation. So now they may go less visible. It may become more hidden. Whereas, you know, it had been identified, their labor had been identified. This is the opportunity to like correct and support. And if you don't do it at that moment, then it may become much more difficult to intervene on behalf of the child. So any solution that's pursued should actually improve the child's situation and not make them more vulnerable. The ETI recommends consulting the child and their family or guardian and involving relevant professionals or other trusted stakeholders as needed. And that sounds like what the Department of Labor intended. In one of the articles, it talks about how they had wanted to, you know, tell children to be referred to schools and to different institutions that could provide services, but it wasn't enough of a link to really link the child to the services. And due to privacy concerns, they didn't cement that linkage. And it doesn't seem like then it succeeded or happened to the extent that it needed to. But I remember when, almost 20 years ago, I was working at a firm that was doing labor audits in China. And at the time, the ETI was really rolling out this framework in order to remediate child labor. And so I was working with my colleagues who were on the ground in China, working in factories, finding underage children, and then trying to follow these directives. And I was trying to just give them, you know, a small amount of guidance to support their effort. And the things that they did included, working out a plan with factory management, getting in touch with the child's family or guardian, making a plan to transport the child with a factory representative and or my colleague to go and travel basically back home on a train to a province hours away in order to return this child directly to their family. But that wasn't really the end of it. There were other suggestions given that included things like replacing the income of that family. So looking at the household and seeing if there was another person that could come and take the place of the child in order to not lose out on that income, but basically give someone else the job in a way that that same household could continue to benefit from the income. And I'm aware of brands. I want to say Adidas is one of them, who over the years have done things like continue to pay that child's salary while they go back to school. So because they're a brand that's affiliated with a supplier who used child labor, they make a commitment and that child's income continues to go to the family while the child is back in school. And then when they finish school, they're guaranteed a job once they're actually old enough to be employed in that type of work and in that setting. And the ETI has an added section in their principle for dealing with child labor, and that is if you believe the children have been trafficked. Now, of course, the U.S. government is starting an investigation to look into that. Like, is that something that happened for these children that we've been reading about? If so, there are additional recommendations from the ETI, and one is that the child should be removed to a safe place, like a government, a child protection official should be involved, or a local child rights organization, to ensure that they're not moved into a worse situation. And if any trafficking or other criminal activity is involved, then relevant authorities need to be contacted. And the supplier or whoever has employed those children should provide updates as to the status of that child and a confirmation that they, you know, did not remain in the same situation, you know, basically under the control of whatever criminal group they were with. So these are, again, considered best practices for child labor remediation. And that really means fixing the situation of that child that you found at work in illegal and unsafe practices. But ultimately, in order to address things like what's happening in the U.S. right now, there's the, you know, the immediate fix of protecting that child. But then there's the mid to long term view of how do you address what is currently driving children into these illegal labor situations. Now, earlier I talked about some of the drivers of child labor globally, things like poverty, barriers to education. But certainly, I think the one that's relevant to the current situation in the U.S. is more related to labor shortages. I think based on what we've read in these news articles, which, you know, are investigations that just seem extremely well done, what we are reading about is what to me seems like a very apparent willingness to hire children. The Department of Labor released some photographs of the children that had been hired at the slaughterhouses when they did that big investigation last fall, and they look young. I mean, you look at the photo and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, that is a kid. That means everyone knew, not only the person that hired them, the person that trained them, the supervisor on the shift, the people that were working around them. It was very obvious. It's not always obvious. If the person is 15 or 16, it starts to become much more difficult to identify what you think their age is. But some of these kids were young enough that visually it was obvious. So why was that happening? Why were they so willing to hire children, given that it's illegal to do it in the context that in which they did? And I think it's more linked to worker shortages than anything. They need people and they don't have them. So I'm not going to, you know, be able to talk about how to fix the whole worker shortage in the U.S. As I wrap up this podcast. But as much as it relates to the impact of the drivers of child labor in the U.S., personally, I think what I would most like to see is just a recognition that there's been a lot of shift in jobs in the labor market. We have actually very low unemployment rates right now. And yet we do have a lot of shortages in areas, growth in other areas. I've read articles all throughout COVID of just the developing mismatch of where jobs are located and where people without jobs are located, or the sectors that kind of contracted during COVID that haven't, and different ones that expanded, and there's a mismatch in those skill sets. But I think in particular, just the types of jobs that we have found these children in these particular investigations are definitely sectors that we usually have a lot of migrants involved in. I certainly would like to see our foreign worker visa program revamped and made just more realistic to our labor situation, to what our supply and demand is for labor, and make a safe work environment for everyone, where we can benefit from people that want these jobs and are willing to work these jobs. And to me, that just seems like a win-win, especially if it helps us make progress on the elimination of child labor. And that's a wrap on our deep dive into child labor in the United States. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Please subscribe to Business and Human Rights with Rochelle for weekly news content and other deep dives, and be sure to check out my Instagram and TikTok for more insight. Until then, have a great week.